You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And, of course, being the second Wednesday of the month between 1 and 2, we have our friends in from Hutchinson Legal to talk about all things legal. And I have with me today Rod. Welcome, Rod.
Yeah, hi. Good to be here.
Great. Great to have you too. Now, we've heard quite a bit about planning. The state government's been saying they're going to take planning, a lot of the planning, away from councils. And the question was, what will the changes be? And obviously are they designed to get more places in, or just speed the system up, or what was the whole idea behind it, Rod?
It's all of the above.
Is it?
Yep. The Victorian government recognised that there is a housing problem in Melbourne, and that as a result of all the immigration that we've got, people have to be housed somewhere. Yep. And so it was a choice between either pushing people out into regional areas, redeveloping Melbourne.
Because governments don't like that, because then they've got to put in more infrastructure, don't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. That's the problem that the government's facing. Do they put a lot of money into infrastructure, develop the areas around Melbourne, for roads, sewerage, telecoms, everything that a modern society needs, or do they try and build up established areas?
Yep.
And they've taken that last approach.
Yep.
The idea is to build up established areas, particularly areas that are well serviced by public transport.
Yep. So then they don't have to put trains and buses and all that in.
Exactly.
So what are the actual differences, Rod? Is it smaller blocks? Is it more density or what?
Well, it's certainly higher density anyway.
Yep.
The government's done this by changes to the Planning and Environment Act.
Right.
So that's allowed them to make changes to the planning schemes.
Right.
And through that, they are taking some powers away from the local councils.
Right. And that's obviously designed to speed it up.
Exactly.
Yep.
So the idea is that developments, and what we're really talking about in these instances, small-scale developments.
Yep.
That meet certain criteria.
When you say small scale, you're talking like houses in backyards and things like that.
Small developments of typical suburban plots of land.
Right.
That's where most of the changes are happening.
Right.
So what you'll find in Melbourne is that the local neighbourhoods are changing.
Yep.
So what we'll used to in the past, the quarter acre block for a typical house, no longer
holding. Not many now, is
there? No, there isn't.
So will that affect... If, for instance, there's where somebody buys just a few blocks of land in an area, so will they no longer be able to build on a quarter acre block? Will they be required to subdivide?
No, you won't have to subdivide, but you'll be able to if you want to.
Ah, right. So there's no compulsion, it's just if you want to do it.
Correct, that's right.
Which the developers want to do.
Exactly. the idea is to... cut out some of the red tape so that the developers can put buildings up more quickly than they have been able to in the past.
Well, that's part of the thing, isn't it, that they need them up. Like, it's no good saying, well, we can build them in 5 years. The crisis is now, not in 5 years.
That's right. Yep. If you look at the immigration statistics over the last couple of years, we're record levels immigration, and those people have to have somewhere to stay.
Yeah.
So, in response, this is what our state government has been doing.
Right.
So, certainly, there are going to be mixed feelings around.
Yep.
You're going to have two diametrically opposed camps, effectively, as a result of this.
Yep.
There's the NIMBYs.
Who, right in my backyard.
That's right. Yeah. And there'll be the YIMBYs. Yes, in my backyard. Some people will want to make money. And there's certainly opportunity for some people to make money.
Yep. So, Rod, if a part of these planning permits, like if somebody wants to sell off their backyard, will it be easier to sell it?
Yes.
Is that part of the planning process?
It is.
Oh, right. Or will it also say you don't want to sell off your backyard, but you want to build something in your backyard? Will that also be changes in this as well?
Yep. Yeah, it does. It doesn't particularly matter whether you're selling or you're going to subdivide and build yourself.
Yep.
The idea is that the process is going to be simpler for people who want that to happen.
Probably a bit of an unfair question, but I'll ask you, is it going, apart from it saving time, is it going to be less costly, do you know, or is that an unfair question?
Bit early to say whether it's going to achieve that particular aim. Certainly, the government's hoping it's going to cost less. They are trying to make housing more affordable, and they're saying one of the ways of being able to achieve that is by have smaller blocks of land that are cheaper themselves to purchase and develop on.
So, right, apart from in Melbourne, or we're talking about the major cities now, if you were going to subdivide in the country, say, well, Ballarat, Bendigo, Shepparton, I'll throw a whole lot of names in there because I don't want to pick out any particular one, will they also be expected to, if you're going to put a subdivision through, to have smaller blocks in the country as well, or is this only in Melbourne?
No, it's Victoria-wide.
Ah, right.
And it's really going to be up to the developers to decide how they can make the most money out of whatever land that they own.
Well, let's be honest, the more blocks you can make, the more money you're going to make, isn't it?
Exactly. And you will see it in some of the smaller towns. Yep. Smaller blocks are going in for that very reason.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for people to make more money.
Yeah. And I suppose, I can be both sides of the fence because I've got a decent backyard and it was great when the kids were growing up. But a lot of people now are so time poor that the guy or the woman doesn't want to spend time cutting grass out in the backyard and all that sort of stuff, do they? So I guess it can achieve two sorts of levels too, can't it?
It does. And I'm on a decent-sized block and I spend a fair bit of time cutting my grass as well. But I am certainly getting to an age where I won't want to do that for too much longer. So I can certainly understand why people move into small blocks.
Yep.
The trouble, I think, is for young families, they can't afford a large block, and they're the ones that probably would benefit the most from having a large block.
Right. If I've got a block of a house on a large block of land, there's nothing in this legislation that's going to make me put something in the backyard, is it?
No.
Like I can still sell that property as it is or do whatever I like with it.
Correct.
There's nothing to make sure, say I have to do something.
Not if it's your principal place of residence. Because the other thing the state government's doing is making changes to the vacant residential land tax.
I want to come back to that in half a tick. I've just got to take a quick break, right?
We can
to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And hello, Grant, if you're listening. Roy, do you want to tell us a bit more about the actual changes?
Okay, yes. So, some of the changes include, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, is that they're codifying residential development requirements.
What's that mean?
I was just about to explain. What that means is they're taking discretions away from council. In other words, there's going to be a prescription. If your development, your proposal fits within that prescription, then it'll just happen.
Oh, so it'll be one one fit all sort of thing.
Not so much one fit in, but if, as long as what you're proposing fits within these guidelines or these standards, then it will happen.
The council
does not have the ability to stop you doing what you're proposing to do.
When do these come in, Rod, or are they already in?
They are in already.
Right, yep.
Another one is that if there's a single dwelling application on lots of less than 300 square metres, so we're talking about small block of land, then the idea is that happens within 10 days.
So they're really pushing. So if I had a quarter acre block, that's not going to come under the same rules, is it? That's going to take longer. But if I cut it in half, then it'll go within 10 days.
That's the theory behind it. It'll be interesting to see how well this is playing out in real life.
Yep.
There's also going to... they're going to remove the need for a planning permit for a single dwelling on a lot of 300 square metres or more.
Yeah, because so, you used to have to... tell all your neighbours,
put a sign up the front of the
and
property.
And give it 30 days or whatever it was.
To object, yep.
Yep.
And these things are changing.
So that's going all together, is it?
I'd have to take that one on notice.
Right,
I'm not particularly sure of that answer. All right, and there's going to be a new streamlined development approval process for social housing developments as well.
Now, can I just ask you, Rod, we hear all this word social housing, but what's actually social housing?
It's supposed to be government-funded housing. So whether they engage with private rental providers to provide housing stock, or whether they build something themselves, or whether they enter into a joint venture with a developer, put up, say, a 10-storey building, and so much has to be either affordable, in other words, below a certain price, or alternatively made available for the government to put in public housing.
All right, so who decides what's affordable?
The government.
I just asked it.
There's some of the changes that are being introduced, and it's certainly going to change our neighbourhoods, there's no question of that.
Yep. Now, vacant land tax. You frightened me when you said that. What what do you mean by that?
Okay, so there are more changes happening to the vacant residential land tax.
Right.
So first thing to note there is that applies to residential land.
Yep.
It does not apply to farming, industrial, commercial.
Right.
It may pick up some mixed zones, so you have a mix of residential and commercial, then it could well be caught up.
Because some of these, with the apartments in particular, they have shops at the bottom, don't they, and then apartments above.
Exactly. So they could well be caught up in the vacant residential land tax.
Right.
So basically what the government's trying to do here is ensure that the land is put to what they say is good use. In other words, can't sit on a block of land or a house and just keep it vacant because you just want it to appreciate over time.
Well, I was just going to say that. So if I owned a block at, say, which I don't, in Doncaster or something like that, and I just knock the old house down and I think, oh, I'll just sit on that for the next 5 years, so I'm going to be hit with a tax for holding that, am I?
Yes, that's right. So the old method where people were buying blocks of land to sit on for their retirement is going to be harder to achieve with these kinds of taxes. Right. So because if it's just sitting there unused, the government's going to tax you.
What about, and I've heard this said before, about land banking. So a developer buys, you know, 50 acres outside of Melbourne, we'll say down Pakenham Way or outside of Frankston or something, and sit on that. Is that going to be caught up in this too?
Not this particular set of changes. They're all caught up in the previous set,
right,
where it's effectively a windfall tax, where when farming land was rezoned, then there was a special extra tax applied, so the government got at least some of the benefits of the rezoning.
Jeez, they get you coming each which way, don't they?
True, they do.
Yep.
All right, okay, so the vacant residential land tax. All right, so if your property's sitting vacant for 1 year...
We're talking only land, aren't we? If it's got a house on it, it's not applied to all.
Okay, so it can apply to, at least from... January next year, so 1st of January 2026, what they call unimproved land is going to be taxed as well. Not in this year, but will happen from next year.
Oh, right. So if you're just sitting on a house too, that's going to come under these taxes too?
Yes, it will.
Do we know what sort of percent, Rod?
We do. So first year, if it's vacant for the first year, you pay 1% of the capital improved value.
Right.
So if you had $1 million property, that's $10,000 that in tax you pay for having that idle.
Just having it idle.
Yep. If it's vacant for a second year, you double. It's now 2% of the capital improved value. Right. So you're now paying $20,000 a year in tax.
But you've already paid 10, haven't you? Is that right?
You paid 10 for the first year.
And then now 20.
Now you're going to pay another 20 on top of that.
So you've got $30,000 in 2 years.
Yes. And third year. So third year and beyond, it's 3% of the capital improved value that has to be paid in tax each year.
Gee, that's going to add up. So you can see what's here. Nobody's going to hold them for that long, are they?
Well, not vacant anyway. No. So the idea is you put people into those properties.
Yep.
And you do that either by selling it to someone who will live in it or you rent it out.
Rent out. Because, I mean, I don't know how true this is, but, I mean, you've heard stories of people from other countries buying properties and just letting them sit there, haven't we?
Correct, that's right. So where that has happened in the past, the government's using a couple of measures to try and stop that from happening.
Yep.
They don't want foreigners just sitting on land, valuable land, and not doing anything with it.
Yep.
So that Australian government and the people here just can't take advantage of that particular property.
Property.
So they've introduced the foreign... I've forgotten the actual name for it now, but it's the foreign...
Oh, so that's a separate
foreign
tax.
Foreign buyer's tax.
That's not actually the vacant land tax. No, that's another one.
That's another one for people from overseas buying property in Victoria.
Right.
So that's come in. This vacant land tax is additional to other taxes, but it affects everyone who owns property in Victoria.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more.
Feels bad. Keep on walking.
Listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back, and I'm talking to Rod from Hutchison Legal. Now, Rod, just going on with these taxes again, there's another set of rules for holiday homes.
There are. So, and that is that there are exemptions that apply for holiday homes.
Right.
Previously it was only around Melbourne, but now it's all throughout Victoria.
So if you own a holiday house out in the country?
Yep.
Same basis.
It's going to apply. And the rule is that if you stay in your holiday home for more than 4 weeks in any given 12 months, you'll be exempt from paying the vacant residential land tax.
Right. And they'll be checking that.
They will, most likely. And the other thing, though, is to get the exemption, you have to apply for it.
Yep.
Typically, it's in January of each year. You have to say you've stayed in your property therefore claim the exemption.
Do you have to have proof? Like, do you have to sign a SAD deck, or just claim it?
Yeah. Just keep in mind, could well be investigated.
Well, they have the power to look at your power usage, don't they? And also your electricity, water
usage, exactly.
Yeah.
So you do want to be careful. You don't want to be seen to be committing tax fraud, which is what that might amount to if you're not providing the correct details to the government.
Because very often, I don't know if it's a general rule, but someone once told me if you evade tax, the penalty is double what you would have evaded. So,
well, for some of these, it's from 25% to 75% on top of the tax you're supposed to pay.
Yeah,
the penalties can be severe.
Yeah, you get really hit, don't you?
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else, Rod?
I'll just note there that as of 2026, so 1st of January 26, this land tax will also apply to undeveloped blocks, so vacant land, with no homes on it. So people who in the past would buy property, consider that as something for their retirement, and sell it later, means that the people who had done that will now either have to pay tax on what they thought was going to be the retirement, or sell the property if they can't afford to continue to pay this land tax.
And probably more people are going to sell than.
Well, exactly, which is why the government's doing this. They want more houses on vacant blocks.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. David Oden, this song is for you.
You
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Rod, there are a couple of things we'd like you to have a look at for next month. One of them, this won't surprise you. I reckon the last 12 months we've had questions about bail each and every time. Now, up till now, people have been saying, and this is quite topical because this person rang me earlier in the week. And, of course, we're here last night, the bail conditions are supposedly going to change. Now, they want you to actually look at what the changes are, because what we get told sometimes, I'm not having a go at anybody here, isn't quite the nitty-gritty. So it could be icing on the cake. So we'd like to know what the actual changes are, how much harder it's going to be to get bail, legally-wise, not what we think legally-wise.
Yep, no problem.
The other thing is we've got we've had somebody ring in, and I'll say it's a football club because it's not a football club. It's actually another form of sport. They run on, they get money coming in through the gate, and they work on grants and all sorts of stuff to get their money. They've, over the last 12 months, they've shown a debt, they've a $1,000 loss over the period of the last 12 months. Now, somebody in the organisation does get paid some money to do a job, and that is part of the $1,000 loss. Now, they've, the person that does their job has asked for an increase, and they've now given the person an increase of a few thousand dollars. Now, is this person that's rung me wants to know, is that legal? Because you're actually taking a loss and making a bigger loss. So if you could look at the legally side of that, because I promised this person we'd have a look at it.
Okay, no worries. Well, we'll certainly look into that one. We will be making a couple of assumptions along the way here.
Yep.
The first assumption is going to be that this sporting organisation is a not-for-profit organisation.
Yes, yep.
And that it's also incorporated in Victoria.
Yep.
And we're also going to make the assumption that this other extra payment is an honorarium of some kind. It's not actual wages.
I think it might be wages.
Wages will be treated slightly differently.
Well, could you look at both? Because I think it may be wages. Because it's still going to go into a...
If it's $6,000, it's unlikely to be much in the way of wages.
No, but that's on top of what the person's already getting.
Okay. All right. No worries.
Anyway, if you can have a look at that.
Yep.
Now, solar, you want to talk about solar?
Yeah, I noticed on the way in that you've got solar installed on this particular building.
We're doing our best.
And once I came inside, I saw you had a battery room as well. So you've got solar and batteries.
No. The batteries that are in here don't have anything to do with the solar. Those batteries in there are to run this radio station if we lose power.
No, I would have thought the solar would be connected to it as well. You have to. You would be charging the batteries from somewhere.
It could be, but as I understand it, I don't know. You've got me. But
that's all right.
Because we always had them at the old place where we never had solar. Yep. And the idea is that we can get a generator in and all that, but it all takes time and we'd be off the air. So my understanding is if we have a blackout or like we have a storm and that, we can cross over the batteries and keep going for a number of hours to allow us to get something else done.
All right.
Whether they charge them up there or not, I don't know, to be honest with you.
Okay. So in relation to solar, there was an important change came in last year. So as of the 1st of October in Victoria, this is, other states will follow suit as well.
1st of October last year. So it's already in.
So it's in now. Yep. So new solar systems going in have to comply with what they call a backstop rule.
Backstop rule?
That's right.
Yeah, so all right. Tell me.
What that means is that if the electricity utility company decides there's too much solar going back into the network and they've got nowhere to put that power, then they can issue a command to your inverter saying stop sending power to the network.
Oh, right.
So that's... has been important in the past for people who rely on feed-in tariffs to help reduce their bills. Now, feed-in tariffs is another issue again.
And I believe they've dropped considerably, haven't they?
So the minimum amount that retailers can offer as of 1st of June
right.
is going to be, I think it's 0.004 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's negligible.
Because when it came out, some people were getting something like 30 cents, weren't they?
Well, I can remember going back more than 20 years ago,
yep.
it was 60 cents per kilowatt hour is what people could get.
And now we're talking, what, point zero?
0.004 cents per kilowatt hour.
Yep.
But certainly the costs of solar have come down very significantly since then.
Yep.
Solar is now within the reach of many people, as long as the home's suitable for it.
Yep.
Now, in other words, you've got the roof space.
Rod, when you just said that they can issue a command for you to... Do they send that out like a text or something, or no. do they have control of your inverters?
They have control of the inverter.
Do
so
they?
They can issue a signal to your inverter
yep.
to tell it to stop exporting power.
So yeah. they could say, I just want to get this because I don't know anything about this. So you could say, wipe out the whole of the solar in, say, Hillsville if you wanted to for a few hours?
Yes, you could. Sure. And there's two stages to this. One is to tell the inverter stop exporting.
Right.
So in other words, it's still producing power for your own use.
Yeah.
But the second stage is if the network's in dire straits.
Yeah.
Then what they can and they need people to use power from the grid rather than from solar. Right. They'll shut the inverter off. So they'll have that capability, so that rather than consuming electricity you're generating yourself,
yep.
they'll shut down the inverter, so you are having to draw power from the grid if you want to use electricity. But that's supposedly only for extreme events.
And so when's this come into operation?
1st of October last year.
It's already in.
It's in place now. It's not retrospective. So you have an existing system,
right.
you're okay.
Yep.
But as of the 1st of October, all systems going in will have to be compliant with this requirement.
So if you've got one, say, 5 years ago, they can't turn that one off?
Correct. They cannot. This is a significant change for the system, and it's effectively giving utility companies control over equipment that you've purchased and installed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit like Big Brother, isn't it?
It is. Needs to be used responsibly.
Yep.
There are rules around in which it's supposed to be used, but certainly all the indications we're seeing at the moment, because this is still new,
yep.
The utility companies are having difficulty implementing it properly. And
with the machinery, you mean, or just...
Well, their back-end servers
yep.
Are effectively... causing solar systems to stop exporting when there's no requirement for from the national electricity regulator to issue those kinds of demands. So there's a fail-safe mechanism where if your inverter stops communicating with these back-end servers, then it's supposed to stop exporting. So if their servers go down or not available for some reason, then your system is supposed to stop exporting power. So if they've got a problem, a tech problem at their end, suddenly you find you're not exporting power anymore.
Sure. All right, I've got to take a quick break.
I've been shearing sheep. We've been mustering stock. We've been culling out roots. We've been spraying the crops. We've been droving cattle up an old stock route. Now it's Saturday night. We pile in the ute. We're the boys from the bush and we're back in town. Well, the dog's in the bag and the foot goes down. Members of the Outback Club. Where the boys from the bush come in from the scrub. Been out in the heat. We've been loading the trucks. Been fixing fences. We've been choking on dust. We curse the rain. We curse the drought.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Rod, I know that part of your job, and probably a big part of it, is being involved in wills. Am I right?
It is now.
Right. So what do you find is the biggest mistake that people make in their wills?
It's a complicated question because it really depends on the family relationships that exist for people.
Yep.
So there are.
But they can change too.
That's right, they do, exactly. Yep. So choice of executor is one.
Is it?
Issue where people think they want to involve all their family members. Say they've got three children, they want to make all three children executors.
And then if they don't get along.
And if they do not get along, then it makes it very hard for us as lawyers to assist them deal with what they need to do to distribute the estate to the beneficiaries.
So, Roddy, you're suggesting you should only have one or should you not have a family member?
And this is where I'm saying, saying relationships matter.
Yep.
We don't know what the relationships are like as lawyers.
Yep.
We do rely on our clients coming in to tell us who they think might be best. All we can do is point out potential pitfalls of doing it particular ways, and it's really up to the client then to decide, do they want one executor, two or three? The important thing to note is if there are joint executors and there are problems, it will delay what's happening and may contribute to additional expenses later.
Could go into court.
To sort out the differences.
Yep. Because what I'm thinking is, pardon me, people can start off thinking, well, their kids get along, and then when money comes involved, all of a sudden it's not quite the same, is it?
You're exactly right there. Yeah. So that's one key factor.
Yep.
The other key factor is that the relationships between siblings themselves can change just because the parents are no longer around.
Oh, yeah.
So parents can operate as a moderating influence and get involved in disputes, calm the waters, so to say.
Yeah.
Once they're no longer around, then what might have been under the surface comes to the top.
Yep.
And these issues then affect how the executors are trying to do their jobs.
Right. I'll ask you another question. If you've got, say, three children, and I'm talking about what you've experienced, not about hypotheticals. So do you find that sometimes that those children can be influenced by their partner?
I'm still new to this particular area, wills and estates, but certainly from an anecdotal viewpoint, it does happen.
Does it?
Because there are significant others who may not be named in the will, but as you say, partners of executors, partners of beneficiaries who have got very strong views who then influence people who are trying to make decisions.
Yeah, I was just thinking that you could very easily get three kids getting along all right, and then one of the partners of one of those says, no, we want our money now, or we've got to do this or we've got to do that. And sometimes people would buckle, I would think.
They do. Yep. No question.
So second biggest problem that you can see?
Not leaving people out of the will. Make sure that people who have been dependent on you in some way have been at least considered.
Right.
Because it can be expensive to deal with a matter where someone who probably should have been entitled to something from the estate were not in the estate and they go and challenge it. And those costs typically come out of the estate.
Yep. All right. So if you've, for some reason, you wanted to cut somebody out of your will, do you need to leave a detailed reason in the will why you did that?
No, you don't need to. As long as they're not financially dependent on the deceased person, that's not necessary.
Right, so the only person that's really like that is either children or a person with a disability. Is that the only categories?
There are probably some other exceptions that don't come to mind at the moment, right. But certainly they're the key ones. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly nothing wrong with putting a letter with the will, just explaining your reasons.
Yep.
Generally speaking, the will takes precedence. So if the instructions in the will are clear, the letter won't mean anything other than it might give peace of mind to someone else.
All right, so I'm a bit mindful of assets. So in the will, you've said, well, I'll give this item to Charlie Brown or my son or whoever it might be, daughter, whoever. You might sell that asset. So you really need to make sure that you keep updating your will, don't you?
If there's, well, that's going to depend on the size of that asset, whatever it might be.
Right.
If you sell it, generally there's a principle involved here called redemption. Not many people know about it.
I've never heard of that, yes.
And what it means is that if there's a specific gift that's no longer available at the time of death, then whatever it was transferred to is generally not available to that beneficiary.
So if you own something and you've sold it, so they're not entitled to that amount. Well, say you sold it for $100,000, they're not entitled to another $100,000 out of your will.
Generally, that's correct. I mean, there are some exceptions, like there are in most things in law. but the general rule is that if you dispose of the asset before death, then that beneficiary misses out.
Yes, ma'am. I'm not having a shot at you or anyone, but that's why lawyers are around, aren't they?
Yes. But I must say, in our defence, real life is complicated.
Oh, I agree.
And there's all sorts of different factual situations that's very hard to cater for.
And the problem is, when we think we're lawyers and we think we can save some money.
particularly from relatives.
Thanks, Rod. It's great to have you along. We'll look forward to hearing from somebody same time next month from Hutchison Legal. Thank you, Rod.
Thank you.